You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
My topic related to this series has to do with freedom, and specifically the question, what is true freedom? Why have I chosen this topic for this Above the Noise series? That's what I want to explain before we get into it. You know, this topic of freedom is like about as American as you can get. You know, it's perennially one of the most popular words in our culture. This is common ground. One of the few common grounds is that virtually all Americans agree that freedom's good and that freedom is actually essential for human flourishing. The problem is that beneath this, in my view, rather superficial agreement, although I'm glad we have this agreement, there's really a lot of confusion about what freedom is. And also, when we begin to explore this topic, a lot of disagreement about what true freedom is. I'm reminded of a time in Jesus' public ministry, recorded in John 8, when Jesus was talking to his own countrymen, and what becomes apparent is that they're both using the same term, freedom, but they're talking at cross purposes with each other. They keep referring to freedom, meaning by it one thing, and he keeps trying to redefine freedom for them. And I think that's the position that we find ourselves in our culture today, especially those of us who are followers of Jesus. Broadly speaking, and granted, this whole area is complicated and it's nuanced, and I'm going to try really hard not to caricaturize or oversimplify, but on the other hand, I have 45 minutes, so it's kind of difficult. What we have in our culture is a collision between two different views of freedom. There is a much older view of freedom, encompassing not only a Greek culture, but even preceding it, a view of freedom that comes out of the biblical worldview. Many Americans seem unfamiliar with the fact that the theme of freedom is a major biblical theme. The historical event in the Old Testament that becomes the most essential event is the Exodus, in which God liberated his people from Pharaoh and brought them out of Egypt. Jesus made a big deal of people in his day being enslaved in a destructive way by faulty religious teaching and religious prohibitions. And so, Paul said in Galatians chapter 5, it was for freedom that Christ set you free. So keep standing firm and don't be subject again to a yoke of bondage. So there's a rich theme of freedom in the Bible and a rich development of that theme. And then there is the more recent view, which I'm calling the secular view. By recent, I don't mean like yesterday or in the 2010s. I mean recent historically, in the last 300 years, emerging from what has been called the Enlightenment in Europe and the Romantic movement in the arts. And this is secular in the sense that this movement and its view of freedom was a conscious break from the biblical worldview and a conscious rejection of the Bible's view of freedom. So they really are in antithesis to one another to a great degree. I'm going to argue, obviously, in favor of the older biblical view. I'm going to try my best to do that in a fair and objective way. One of the things that means is that when I'm quoting advocates of the secular view, I'm going to quote the advocates, not their opponents. I think it's important that those of us in this church agree that people have the freedom to choose their own view of freedom, and that we should be, of all people, respectful toward those who disagree with our view of freedom. But at the same time, to underscore, it's hard to exaggerate how significant it is which view of freedom you embrace as a person. You should embrace it knowing the alternatives, and you should embrace it as an informed decision, because the view of freedom that you embrace will have a tremendous ripple effect on your own life, on the life of your children and family, and on our society. And that's exactly one of the ways that we can evaluate our society today in this collision. Well, there are some areas in which both of these views agree. To use just the most basic of Venn diagrams, there are more differences than there are similarities, but there are key similarities. Both of these views of freedom are negative in the sense that they're trying to describe freedom from oppressive powers and authorities. And so that's deep in our national consciousness, the American Revolution, the Civil Rights Movement, etc. Where they diverge in this area is that the biblical view, I think, says there are additional powers and authorities from which we need to be free than what the secular view claims. They both are positive in the sense that they're both trying to describe a freedom that enables us to make significant personal decisions. They both agree that if you're going to flourish as a human being, you can't be reduced to a robot. You can't be controlled completely by other powers. That, choosing to get educated and decide what worldview you will believe in is a freedom that you need to have. Choosing your life's mate versus having your marriage life arranged for you. We go on and on. Choosing, having some freedom to choose a career path or where you live. That's part of what it means to flourish as an individual, to have choice, or as we say today, for our voice to be heard is one way of expressing that. Here again, the biblical view of freedom is going to affirm this, the freedoms that I've just mentioned, the positive freedoms, but it's going to say that there's a more radical end of our personal choices than to simply multiply personal choices. What I want to spend most of our time on this morning then is to think about the contrasts between these two views of freedom and to tease out some of the implications. And we're going to look at four contrasts. The first contrast that I want us to look at has to do with the emphasis of each of these views. The secular view of freedom tends to emphasize the absence of restraints from restraints that restrain us from pursuing our personal desires. Again, both views have this category, but this is a strong emphasis in the secular view. Here are just a couple of quotes from different dictionaries, English dictionaries, and you can see that emphasis coming across very clearly. The absence of hindrance, restraint, confinement, or repression. Not enslaved, not imprisoned, unrestricted, unrestrained, unhampered. That's a symbol. That flag, which goes all the way back to the Revolutionary War period, is a symbol of this emphasis that when we think about freedom, it's about the fact that we don't want anyone else treading on us. Again, doesn't make it good or bad. It expresses the emphasis of this view of freedom. Now, Wayne Dyer, of course, along with Deepak Chopra, such popular spokesman for many things, including this view of freedom, he says, freedom means you are unobstructed in living your life as you choose. Anything less is a form of slavery. You can see that emphasis in that quote. Now, again, the biblical view of freedom says to be excessively restrained, to have your own choice taken from you in a substantial way is an evil. And it's something that God does not want for human beings. But the biblical view of freedom is essentially different in its emphasis. And if you don't get anything else this morning, this is the contrast that you want to get. The biblical view of freedom emphasizes that freedom means fulfilling our design. It presupposes that we are created and that we've been created teleologically. Teleologically means for a purpose. Telos is the Greek word for purpose or end. Human beings have been created with a common design and for a common purpose. So then, therefore, immediately, unrestrained, unlimited choice is something different than the biblical view of freedom. There are such things as flying fish, but a flying fish is kind of a caricature because even the species that we call the flying fish just spends brief moments of their existence outside of the water. A fish is free to live in the environment in which it was designed to live. That's an illustration of the biblical view. Eagles can walk on earth. Eagles are not free teleologically to try to run marathons. They weren't designed. Their feet and their structure weren't designed to run long distances. They are most free when they're flying, because that was the end for which they were designed. Now, this is what Jesus is getting at when he was asked by a religious scholar in his day, which is the most important commandment of the law of Moses? This scholar believed that the law of Moses was inspired by God, that it was communicating vital information. And Jesus replied by quoting two of the commands. You must love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And a second is equally important. Love your neighbor as yourself. The entire law and all of the demands of the prophets are based on these two commandments. And so what Jesus is saying here, and he wasn't innovating, it was taught in the Old Testament too, is that the design for which God created humans, the end or the purpose of our existence, is to be in love relationships. That we were created by not only a loving God, but as the Bible reveals God, a God who is himself or a loving community of persons who have always existed loving each other, and that human beings then have been created in the image of that triune God. Therefore, we've been created to be in love relationships. That's the water in which we swim. That's the air in which we fly, both to receive and experience, first of all, the love of God in a personal way, and then to live our lives out expressing that love back to God and to one another. That is our design. We are not free with any other end. So they're essentially different stances on freedom. This is why Paul says in one of his letters, if you love your neighbor then you're fulfilling the requirements of God's law. For the commandments say, don't commit adultery, don't murder, don't steal, don't covet. But these and other such commandments, which are negative, and there's a place for the prohibition, just like telling a fish, don't try to live your whole life outside of water, just like telling an eagle, don't try to run a marathon. But these are summed up and subsumed under the positive command, which is to love your neighbor as yourself. It's love that does no wrong to others, so love fulfills the requirements of God's law. Seeing biblical ethics, then, not as essentially restrictive prohibitions, but seeing the ethical content of the Bible as essentially a design manual to describe for us and to begin at least to guide us into the end for which we were created. That's the biblical view. And that's why Jesus made this statement, which is still pretty well known. He said, "Come to me, all of you who are weary and carry heavy burdens." And he was speaking to people who were weary and burdened by man-made religious prohibitions that had been laid on them that God never designed them to be under. He said, "Come to me, all of you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I'll give you rest." Rest is a synonym for freedom in this passage. "Take my yoke upon you." That sounds paradoxical, right? How could you be free if you have a yoke like an oxen yoke on you? Well, it depends on which view of freedom you subscribe to. If freedom is the absolute absence of all restraint, then all yokes are bondage. But Jesus says, no, you were designed for a yoke, and it's the yoke that I have upon me. When he was here, he lived to love his Father, and he lived to love other people. Let me teach you this way of life, because I'm humble and I'm gentle at heart, and then you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy to bear. It's made for you. You were made for it. And the burden I give you is a light burden. Now, let's talk about a second key contrast between these two views of freedom. The secular view of freedom carries with it an assumption that our inner self and the desires of our inner self are essentially good and trustworthy. This is the slogan that I grew up under in high school in the late 60s. If it feels good, do it. And to be fair, that wasn't just an unqualified advocacy of hedonism and pleasure seeking. Of course, we hijacked it for that purpose. It was meant to be broader and more meaningful. But you see the assumption behind that view. It both assumes that freedom is when you do what you want to do, and the assumption is that you have within yourselves the mechanism, the wherewithal, in your desires. Your desires will guide you toward freedom. Eckhart Tolle, who's called by the New York Times the most popular spiritual teacher in America, says it this way: to know yourself as the being underneath the thinker, as the stillness under the mental noise, as the joy underneath the pain, that is freedom and enlightenment. And so the assumption is that within ourselves are, they are bent in the way that we're meant to go, and that we are really, what life is about is following that voice within. And this really comes in our culture from the Romantic movement in the 1800s, poets like Walt Whitman, etc., others. Many of you know at least this line from the famous poet William Hensley in his poem Invictus: "I am the master of my fate," or more importantly, "I am the captain of my soul. I know better than anyone else the way to go. I can trust my desires." The big problem is in not trusting your desires, or worse, having others impose their desires on you. Now, when we think about the biblical view, it acknowledges, it affirms that inner self, which the Bible may call our soul or our spirit, is given to us by God. It is made in the image of God. That is, that our capacity to think and reason, our capacity to imagine, our powers of choice and volition are a gift to us from God. And they are good. But the Bible, side by side, insists that that inner self is now fallen. It's now broken. And because it's broken, and broken profoundly by human revolt against following its creator, that guidance mechanism now is very flawed and not trustworthy. Those are huge differences leading in very different directions. Jeremiah. Not too many bumper stickers on this. And yet it encapsulates something that the Bible teaches throughout since Genesis 3. The human heart, the inner self, is now more deceitful than all else. That's a pretty, you know, you think, I can think of a lot of things that are deceitful. Your heart is more deceitful. It's desperately sick. It's humanly incurable. Who can understand, who can fathom the extent to which our inner self is deceitful and sick? That's what God is saying through Jeremiah. And this is why then in the biblical view, as we pursue freedom, David teaches us to make this request: search me, O God, and know my inner self. Why would it be important for me to regularly ask God to search me and know my heart? Precisely because I can't know my own heart. Precisely because it's so deceitful that I deceive myself. And see if there be any hurtful way within me, and lead me in the everlasting way, that ourselves were made, given to us by God, that being fallen and broken, we need God to search our hearts, and we need God to show us the path forward, by which he means not only through the written revelation of God in his word, the Bible, but also through the personal guidance of God's Spirit in our lives as we surrender ourselves to follow him and his son Jesus. It's interesting, the Bible goes on to state a very relevant irony. It tells us that when we embrace an unqualified view of freedom, to follow the inner self, to follow my desires, that what happens ironically is that we eventually become enslaved by our own fallen desires. When Jesus was talking to his countrymen in John 8, they kept wanting to refer to freedom politically and nationalistically, saying we've never been enslaved anyone, which was preposterous. They didn't know their own history because they'd been enslaved virtually the last 1,400 years, and they were currently enslaved politically under Rome. But he kept saying, that's not the freedom I'm talking about. He said, everyone who practices a lifestyle of following your own self-centered desires eventually becomes a slave to those desires. And that's why his disciple, Peter, said, spoke of certain people influencing his audience. He says, with an appeal to twisted desires, they promise you freedom while they themselves are slaves of sin and corruption, because you are a slave to whatever controls you. Isn't it more than a coincidence that our culture, which enjoys an unparalleled embrace of this secular view of freedom, and which enjoys unparalleled personal freedoms to follow our own desires, is it a coincidence that that same culture is afflicted with unparalleled addictions? You see the connection? That's not an accident according to the biblical worldview. When we embrace this definition of freedom and sell out to it, then we become enslaved to our very desires and corrupted or broken down by them. John Stott, a well-known Christian thinker in the 20th century, said our self-centeredness, which is really probably the best contemporary term for what the Bible calls sin. Sin is not a helpful word for use in our culture because it carries such unbiblical connotations. The essence of sin in Scripture is not only a revolt against God's design, but a commitment to our own self-centered desires. Our self-centeredness, he said, is a terrible tyranny. To be engrossed in our own selfish concerns and ambitions without regard either for the glory of our designer or for the good of others is to be confined in the most cramped and unhealthy of prisons. It's intoxicating initially, and you wind up imprisoned by your own freedom. But Stott goes on to say, but the living Jesus, not just the historical Jesus, but the living Jesus who died and was raised again and who lives today, can enter into our very personalities by his Spirit. And he can turn us inside out. Our previously closed and imploded personality can start to unfold toward him, like a flower opening to the rising sun. I like that image because I like flowers. I think that's pretty cool and profoundly true. And that's what I've experienced in my life. And I by no means stand before you as a totally God-centered, totally loving of other person. But I can say that over the last almost 50 years since I met the living Christ and began to let him teach me his way, and began to teach me how to live under his yoke, I think the greatest freedom in my life is the freedom from the imprisonment of my own self-absorption. And that is freedom to begin to live. That's a key part of the abundant life that Jesus said he came to give us. Well, there's a third major contrast between these views of freedom. The secular view of freedom, as we've already seen, emphasizes individual autonomy. That does not say anatomy. I double check that. I triple check. Autonomy. Autonomy means law unto myself. Autos, nomos. Nomos is law. Autos is myself. I am a law. I am the captain of my own ship. Right? It inherently emphasizes individual autonomy, which in turn then in a society is going to promote increasingly radical individualism. Now, individualism is part of the heritage of our country. And again, when you define that in one way, namely a country that's convinced that we need a separation of powers and we need checks and balances so that we don't live under the tyranny of human rulers, then that's a good thing. But we are way beyond that today. And one main reason why we find ourselves in such a fractured, polarized culture in which people increasingly have no common ground and just shriek and bark and grunt at each other has to do with the definition of secular freedom, because it's going to lead you inexorably to say, I want to do what I want to do. I mean, again, a 60s slogan that I grew up on was do your own thing, right? And do whatever you want as long as it doesn't hurt others. I think there's truth in that, but I want to come back to that in just a second, because on one level, when you really look at this and the way that it's applied, it's incredibly naive. The image is that we're all like ships spread out across a huge ocean, and we all have lots of room, and we can just turn and twist as long as we don't directly collide with someone. Reality is not that simple. John Stuart Mill, the only freedom which deserves the name is that of pursuing our own good in our own way, so long as we do not attempt to deprive others of theirs or impede their efforts to obtain it. It's not that that's a false statement, but I think it's again, the underpinnings of if the ideal is for me as much as possible to do whatever I want. Like philosopher D.C. Schindler says, if there's no good higher than individuals' unrestrained wills, then conflict is inevitable. Well, you don't need to go further than your own marriage to realize that, right? Right? In marriage, in many ways, the root problem is you have two self-willed people who commit to love each other and just start colliding with each other, right? And that's why one of the keys to a marriage that's not only lasts, but that becomes increasingly satisfying is that both people are willing to curb that kind of freedom and to freely live under a higher design and learn how to be cooperative teammates. But this view of freedom encourages the conflict that comes from its own definition. That's why we should not be surprised that we find ourselves in this situation. Now, I'm going to state an opinion. So I'm making that very clear. And it's a generalization. But I think one of the great ironies in our present politically polarized and fractured environment is that both sides of the political battle embrace this view of freedom. And they disagree on some of the key application points, but behind it is this view of freedom, and that's why it will never lead to more common ground and more unity in our culture. It can't. The biblical view, remember, emphasizes our relational design, that we're designed for love relationships, not only with God, but with one another, and not only with one another, but with our neighbors who don't believe the same thing that we believe. And then by its very nature, then, biblical freedom requires a commitment to community. It's a major emphasis in Scripture. Paul says in Galatians 5, you've been called to live in freedom. But don't use your freedom to satisfy your selfish desires. You see him immediately defining the kind of freedom he's advocating and resisting. But use your freedom to serve one another in love. Did you know that our English word freedom derives from an Indo-European word which is friend? Think about that. I mean, sometimes etymological connections are not helpful, but I think this is helpful, that the very term freedom derives from the word friend. In other words, freedom is not to be autonomous, but freedom involves being a friend. In the great Exodus event, when God liberated his people from the human bondage of Pharaoh, he delivered them in order to make them a people, a society under him. So this is saying freedom is inherently communal. And that, of course, means that you can't have real freedom in a marriage or in a family, or in a society, without a voluntary self-limitation in certain ways. That's just part, it's a paradox to us. Why does that sound paradoxical? You can't have freedom unless you have limits. Because so deep in the American psyche is the secular view of freedom. It wouldn't sound paradoxical to you if you were deeply imbued with the biblical message. You'd be like, of course. To be free, said Nelson Mandela, the civil rights leader and later president who liberated South Africa from apartheid, to be free is not merely to cast off one's own chains. That's part of it. It's an important part of it. But to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. Now this is, I don't know whether he knew it or not, but he was coming right out of a different worldview. Philip Gorski, a Yale professor, says many Americans conceive of freedom too narrowly as the mere absence of restraint. This is a very grave misunderstanding, not only of America's founding traditions, but also of the very nature of human freedom. True freedom means being subject to the rule of general laws rather than the arbitrary will of other persons. And it's where we are to such a really alarming degree, right? That we've got America fractured into tribes, ranting at each other, not reasoning civilly with each other. The internet was hailed in the 90s as a great tool for bringing people together because it would expose us to different voices and help us to be more broad-minded. Well, there's nothing wrong with that technology. What's wrong is the use that we've made of it, which is to, by algorithms, make sure that you hear the echo of your own voice more and more. And so what we have is exactly the opposite result, and it's rooted in the view of freedom. Finally, the secular view of freedom identifies the main obstacle to freedom as external. And again, there's truth in this. I mean, you look at those images, and we resonate with just about all those images, right? Freedom! What did William Wallace mean? And what did he die for? And he was a hero for doing that. Freedom from the external problem. The gladiator, Abraham Lincoln, the great emancipator, Martin Luther King. So there is great truth in the fact that there are external obstacles and enemies of freedom. And it is right and good to oppose tyranny. And it is heroic when people make personal sacrifices, not only to protect their own human freedom, but to protect the freedom of others. The issue here is more nuanced. It's not whether or not there are significant external obstacles to freedom, but whether that's the main obstacle to freedom. If you teach people, say the authors of The Coddling of the American Mind, if you teach people that whoever says or does the things they find offensive are aggressors, and that's where we are today, microaggressions and macroaggressions, which often distill to you're saying things that I don't agree with, who have committed acts of bigotry against them, then you're probably fostering feelings of victimization, anger, and hopelessness. If someone wanted to create an environment of perpetual anger and intergroup conflict, this would be a very effective way to do it. And when you define freedom as your own right to go your own way, and when you then, as this extrapolates itself, then when you begin to define anyone who doesn't agree with you as a tyrant on the level of Hitler, a dangerous bigot, then you have a recipe for basically an unsolvable social fracturing. And I'm not saying this is the only reason for why we are where we are, but it's a major reason. And that's why any way forward is going to involve lots of people embracing a different view of freedom. Because we are going to pursue freedom. Ironically, God designed us to do that. The biblical view acknowledges the external threats to freedom, but it identifies the main obstacle, the radical obstacle, as inside us. The old pogo cartoon strip, which many of you have never seen. It's okay. You need to know a little bit of your cartoon history. It's very famous, where he's looking in the mirror and he says, we've met the enemy and he is us. This is where the true enemy is. Inside of me. It's not that the other ones aren't real. It's not that the other ones don't need to be opposed. But the real enemy within us is our own self-centeredness, says the Bible. Our own pride, insistence on being the center of our own universe. Our own objective guilt before a God with a definitive moral character who says we are guilty before Him and therefore separated and alienated from Him in a real and profound sense. And then I think one of the major symptoms of such alienation and self-absorption then are the crippling fears that we experience and that our culture experiences increasingly, the crippling anxieties and fears of trying to live as a sovereign when you were never designed to live as your own sovereign. It places a burden on your emotional equipment that you can't handle. And this is where the Bible comes to us with really, really good news. The good news that it brings to us is that Jesus Christ has come to cure and to overcome the real internal obstacles to our freedom. We can't cure this. Have you ever tried by your own willpower to become less self-centered? I've tried that a lot. Have you ever tried through purely through thinking happy thoughts to get freed from fears? I'm not saying there's not some truth in those, but they are not an antidote. We are afflicted with a terminal spiritual disease that requires outside intervention and cure, outside liberation. And that's why Jesus said in that passage in John 8, if the Son sets you free, then you'll be truly free. He will bring the authentic freedom, the freedom in context from your own self, imprison of self and absorption and all that flows from that. He's the only one who can set you free in that genuine way. He's the one who came and laid his life down as a payment for the guilt debt that we hold before an objective God. And you can experience real forgiveness through Jesus Christ. You don't have to understand a lot of Christian doctrine to take your place before God on your own in private and say, oh God, I know that I am guilty before you, and I want your son Jesus to forgive me like he promised he would do. You can have that forgiveness, and you can experience that forgiveness. He is the one, as we saw, who comes ready and able to teach us his way of humility and gentleness rather than the way of pride and self-centeredness. He has both the wisdom and the power to transform our souls in that direction. So Christians don't speak of their faith as a self-help project. We're relating to a living Jesus Christ who says, as you continue to trust me and follow me, I'll change your soul from the inside out. And he's the one, and I speak from personal experience, who has the power to bring substantial liberation from your fears. I still have fears in my life, and I still go through periods of intense fear. And nothing in the Bible says that in this life I'm going to be emancipated from periods of fear. But you know what? What I have found over the decades is that I know where to go with those fears, and that I can go to the living God, and I can pour those my fears out onto him, and I can speak to the risen Christ who's been raised from the dead. He's conquered the greatest enemy of all. He is alive, and he has authority. And as I relate to that God and that Jesus Christ, he brings progressive freedom from those crippling fears. And that's real freedom. And that's what God has for you, the God of the Bible. And that's what the living Jesus Christ has for you. All right, let me close this in prayer. God, just thank you again for the opportunity over these next 4 weeks to think and to hear from you on matters that are so important at this time in our culture. And again, Lord, praying for myself and for my brothers and sisters in Christ here, we do not want to grieve your spirit by being rancorous and angry in a sinful way and contributing to the discord that exists. Help us learn how to take a position and to disagree and to robustly discuss it, but with genuine humility and civility. Help us to be a positive alternative in that way. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.